A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about remote places, islands, research stations, tiny communities where you're stuck with whoever's there and whatever shows up on the supply run. He watched a documentary about an Antarctic research station and found himself thinking, honestly, this looks kind of great. The movie room, the camaraderie, the fact that supplies arrive when they arrive and you just deal. He's asking what it's actually like to live in these places, what's good about it, and here's the part I want to sit with. What someone in a connected, mundane place can learn from people who live at the end of the logistics chain. Not just survival tips. Something deeper about self-sufficiency and being okay with what's in front of you.
The Antarctic station thing. I know exactly the feeling he's describing. I went down a rabbit hole on McMurdo a few years ago and came out the other side wondering if I'd miss my calling. There's something about a place where the last flight leaves in February and doesn't come back until October. You're not deciding whether to stay. The decision's been made. And that's freeing.
The anti-travel, he called it. You're not choosing between 17 restaurants. You're eating what the galley made.
Right. And the research on this is, well, it's scattered across disciplines, but the patterns are surprisingly consistent. Let's start with what these places actually look like. You've got your research stations, Antarctic, Arctic, high-altitude observatories, marine biology stations on atolls. You've got island communities, some with a few hundred people, some with 40. Then there are the industrial outposts, mining towns, offshore platforms, the kind of place where the company built a cafeteria and a dorm, and that's the town.
Fire lookouts.
Fire lookouts, yes. The ultimate, one person, a tower, a radio. But the common thread is what psychologists call a closed environment. You can't leave on a whim. And that constraint does something to how people relate to each other that open environments don't.
Constraint's the word I keep coming back to. Daniel mentioned deep home inventory, knowing exactly what you have because you can't just order more. There's a satisfaction in that. I think most people feel it as anxiety. The idea of running out of something and not being able to fix it.
That anxiety's real, but it flips. There was a study out of the Australian Antarctic Division. They looked at psychological adaptation across a winter over at Davis Station. The first month, anxiety spikes. People are acutely aware of what they've left behind, what they can't get. By month three, something shifts. The constraint becomes the background condition, not the foreground stressor. People stop tracking what's missing and start working with what's there.
Month three. What's that? The point where your brain gives up on scanning for options and just settles in?
Something like that. There's a concept in environmental psychology called psychological detachment. It's usually framed as a negative, the thing that happens when you're cut off from normal life. But in these environments, it seems to function differently. The detachment isn't from meaning, it's from the noise. You stop comparing your situation to alternatives because the alternatives aren't accessible. And when the comparison loop shuts off,
you're just there.
You're just there. And that's where the camaraderie Daniel noticed in the documentary comes from. When nobody can leave, the social calculus changes. In a normal workplace or neighborhood, you can afford to let a minor conflict fester because you can go home. You can avoid the person. You can transfer. In a closed environment, a minor conflict is an existential threat to the group. So, people get good at resolving things fast.
Or they don't. And everyone's miserable for 8 months.
That happens too. The horror stories from early Antarctic expeditions are, well, they're instructive in exactly the wrong direction. But modern stations screen for this. Psychological compatibility is part of the selection process now. NASA does it for long-duration missions. The European Space Agency runs isolation studies where they put 6 people in a mock habitat for months and watch what happens.
What does happen?
The short version, the third quarter, is the hardest. Across multiple isolation studies, there's a consistent dip in morale and cohesion around the midpoint. The novelty of the first phase has worn off, the end isn't close enough to feel real, and people start getting on each other's nerves in ways that feel permanent even though they're not.
So month 3 you settle in, and then sometime around month 5 you want to strangle Day from Logistics.
Day from Logistics is a recurring figure in the literature, yes. But here's what's interesting. The groups that handle the third quarter dip best aren't the ones with the most skilled individuals. They're the ones with the most developed group identity. Shared rituals, inside jokes, a sense that we're the kind of people who do this. The identity work happens early, and it pays off late.
That's a lesson right there. Most workplaces try to build culture from the top down. Mission statements, values posters. These people build it from the bottom up because they have to, and it actually works.
Because the stakes are real. When the mission statement is framed on the wall in the break room, it's decoration. When the mission is, we all survive this winter together, it's not optional.
Daniel asked about natural communities, too. Small islands. I think the dynamics are different when it's not a fixed-term posting. An Antarctic station has an end date. An island community doesn't necessarily.
That's a crucial distinction. Temporary isolation and permanent isolation produce different psychologies. In a temporary closed environment, you can endure hardship because there's a countdown. In a permanent one, endurance isn't the frame, adaptation is. You're not waiting it out, you're building a life.
I've read about the Scottish Islands, the Outer Hebrides, places like that. Communities of a few hundred people where the ferry comes 3 times a week in good weather, and not at all in bad. The people who thrive there aren't the ones gritting their teeth through the isolation. They're the ones who've built such a dense local world that the isolation isn't felt as deprivation.
There's a term for this, place attachment. It's the emotional bond between a person and a specific location. Researchers measure it on 2 axes, place identity, which is how much the place is part of who you think you are, and place dependence, which is how well the place meets your functional needs. In remote communities, both scores tend to be high among long-term residents. The place isn't just where they live, it's who they are.
And that's the thing someone in a city can't just decide to have. You can't manufacture place attachment by reading about it.
No, but you can cultivate the preconditions. One of the findings that comes up repeatedly is that place attachment correlates with active engagement, knowing the history of where you are, participating in local decisions, investing time in relationships with neighbors. The people who score highest on place attachment aren't necessarily the ones who were born there. They're the ones who showed up and did the work.
So the lesson isn't move to a remote island. The lesson is treat wherever you're like a remote island, as if you can't just leave and go somewhere else when it gets hot.
Daniel mentioned deep home inventory, knowing what you have. There's a parallel here, deep place inventory. Knowing the people on your street, knowing which tree flowers first in spring, knowing the history of the building you live in. Most people in connected places don't do any of that because they don't have to. The place is interchangeable.
Interchangeable, that's the word. When everywhere is reachable, nowhere is really home. You're always comparing.
And comparison is the thief of, well, the saying is joy, but it's also the thief of presence. The Antarctic winter over cruise, the small island residence, the fire lookout in a tower in Montana, they're not comparing. The option isn't on the table. And that frees up enormous mental bandwidth.
I want to push on something, though. Daniel described the Antarctic station as looking pretty amazing. The movie room, the camaraderie. And I think there's a romanticization risk here. These places aren't utopias. The isolation can break people. What's the actual prevalence of psychological issues in winter over cruise?
Depends on the study and the station, but clinically significant depressive symptoms show up in about 5 to 10% of winter over personnel across most studies. Subclinical symptoms, the winter over syndrome, they sometimes call it, are higher, maybe 20 to 30%. Irritability, mild cognitive slowing, social withdrawal. The thing is, most people recover quickly when the isolation ends. It's not typically a lasting psychological injury.
And the ones who don't?
Pre-existing vulnerability is the biggest predictor. The screening processes at major stations are pretty good at filtering out people who are likely to have serious problems. What they can't screen for as well is how someone will react to the specific social group they're assigned to. You can be psychologically robust in general and still have a terrible time if you're stuck with 3 people whose personalities clash with yours.
So, even with screening, it's a gamble.
It's a gamble. And that's part of what makes it compelling to read about from a safe distance. Daniel's watching a documentary and thinking this looks amazing. He's not wrong. The amazing parts are real. But he's also not the one dealing with Dave from logistics in month 5.
Let's talk about the supply thing. Daniel mentioned supplies came when they came. That acceptance. I think that's one of the harder things for someone in a connected place to internalize. We're so used to immediate gratification that the idea of waiting weeks or months for something feels like a crisis rather than just how it works.
The Antarctic stations run on a resupply schedule that's essentially annual. The main delivery happens during the summer window, December through February, roughly. After that, you have what you have. If a critical piece of equipment breaks in March, you're either fixing it with what's on hand or doing without until the following November.
And the stations don't collapse.
They don't collapse because the culture of preparedness is baked into everything. Every station has a tradesperson or several electricians, mechanics, carpenters. The skill set of the group is explicitly designed to cover the likely failure modes. And there's an informal economy of improvisation that develops. Someone knows how to weld, someone else knows how to jury-rig a pump, the cook knows how to make something edible out of the last pallet of frozen vegetables.
This is the deep home inventory Daniel was talking about, but applied to skills instead of stuff. Knowing what your community can do, not just what it owns.
And that's transferable. A neighborhood in a city could operate on that principle. Most don't, because the supply chain is so reliable that nobody needs to know their neighbor's skills. But when the supply chain breaks, a natural disaster, a blackout, suddenly the people who know who has a generator and who knows first aid are in a completely different position.
The prepper instinct is to stockpile things, but the remote community instinct is to stockpile relationships.
That's well put. The research on community resilience bears this out. After a disaster, the communities that recover fastest aren't the ones with the most supplies. They're the ones with the densest social networks. People who know each other share resources, coordinate effectively, and provide emotional support that prevents the psychological collapse that makes physical problems worse.
So Daniel's deep home inventory should maybe be a deep neighbor inventory.
Both. The supplies matter. But the supplies without the relationships are just a pile of stuff that one household is hoarding while everyone else suffers.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the third quarter dip. You mentioned that groups with strong shared identity handle it better. What actually builds that identity? If you're dropped into a station with strangers, how do you become a group?
Shared meals are huge. In almost every isolation study, the communal meal emerges as the central ritual. It's not just about nutrition, it's the daily marker that says we're in this together. Stations that let people take food back to their rooms and eat alone tend to have worse outcomes than stations where the galley is the heart of social life.
The galley as social infrastructure. I like that.
Celebrations matter disproportionately too. Midwinter's Day in Antarctic stations, June 21st, the solstice, is a bigger deal than Christmas at a lot of stations. It marks the psychological turning point. After midwinter, the days start getting longer. The end is theoretically visible even if it's still months away. Stations go all out, formal dinners, handmade gifts, sometimes a play or a music performance.
They put on a play.
They put on a play. McMurdo has a long tradition of it. Costumes made out of whatever's available, scripts written by someone on station. It's absurd, and it's essential. The absurdity is the point. It's a collective act of creativity that has no purpose except to be something we did together.
There's something about that, the handmade gift, the improvised play. That's the opposite of how most of us live. We outsource entertainment. We consume what other people made. The idea of making the entertainment yourself, badly, with the people you're stuck with.
It's deeply human. And it's one of the things people miss most when they leave. Former Winter Rover personnel, when you interview them years later, they don't talk about the science they did. They talk about the midwinter play, the inside jokes, the time the generator failed and everyone huddled in the galley with candles.
The hardship becomes the story.
The shared hardship becomes the story. Individual hardship is just suffering. Shared hardship is the raw material for meaning.
Daniel asked what's good about it. I think that's the answer, meaning density. In a connected place, meaning is diffuse, spread across 1,000 shallow interactions, 100 places you've been, a constant low-grade hum of stimulation that never quite satisfies. In a remote community, meaning is concentrated. fewer interactions, but each one carries more weight. Fewer events, but each one matters more.
There's a concept in positive psychology called flow, the state of being completely absorbed in what you're doing. One of the preconditions for flow is clear goals and immediate feedback. Remote environments provide that naturally. The goal is obvious. Keep the station running, survive the winter, maintain the equipment. The feedback is immediate. The generator either works or it doesn't. The meal either feeds people or it doesn't. There's no ambiguity about whether what you're doing matters.
Whereas in an office job, you can go weeks without knowing if anything you did had any effect on anything.
The ambiguity is corrosive. Remote environments strip it away, sometimes brutally. But for the right kind of person, that clarity is deeply satisfying.
What about the wrong kind of person? Daniel's asking what we can learn from this, but I think we should be honest about who this doesn't work for. Not everyone would thrive in a remote community.
The people who struggle most tend to be high in novelty seeking. They need new experiences, new people, new stimulation. If your psychological well-being depends on variety, a closed environment is going to be punishing. Also, people with strong external loci of control. If you need to feel like you have options, like you can change your circumstances by making a different choice, the constraint is going to feel like a prison rather than a liberation.
So the people who thrive are, what, internally motivated, low novelty-seeking, comfortable with routine?
And socially skilled in a specific way. Not necessarily extroverted. Introverts often do very well in these environments because they're comfortable with solitude and don't need constant social stimulation. But they need to be good at the kind of social maintenance that prevents small frictions from becoming big ones. Emotional intelligence, essentially. The ability to read a room and adjust.
The ability to not be Dave from logistics.
Or to be the version of Dave from logistics that everyone can live with for 8 months.
Let's talk about the island communities for a minute. The permanent ones. I think the dynamics shift when there's no end date, and when the community includes families, children, elderly people. A research station is mostly working-age adults on a contract. An island has the full span of human life.
And the full span of human conflict. Small island communities have all the same problems as any other community. Disputes over resources, generational tensions, gossip, feuds, but compressed into a space where avoidance isn't possible. The person you're feuding with is also the person who runs the ferry, or teaches your children, or owns the only shop.
That sounds exhausting.
It can be, but it also produces a kind of social maturity that's rare in more anonymous places. You learn to live with people you disagree with because the alternative is making your own life unlivable. The grudge has a cost, and in a small community, the cost is immediate and personal.
There's a phrase for this in political theory, the veil of ignorance, or something like, no, that's different, but the idea that when you can't exit, you have to negotiate.
Exit, voice, and loyalty. Hirschman's framework. In a connected place, exit is cheap. You don't like your neighborhood, you move. You don't like your friend group, you find new friends. In a remote community, exit is expensive or impossible. So you invest in voice. You speak up, you negotiate, you work things out. And you invest in loyalty. You commit to the group because leaving isn't a realistic option.
So the lesson for someone in a connected place is artificially raise the cost of exit? That sounds like terrible advice.
Not artificially raise it. But recognize that cheap exit has a hidden cost. It prevents you from developing the skills of voice and loyalty. If you leave every time things get hard, you never learn to fix things. And you never experience the depth of relationship that comes from having fixed something together.
That's the thing. Daniel's deep home inventory. It's not just about stuff. It's about sunk cost in a place, in a community. The reason remote community residents have deep inventories is because they've been there long enough to accumulate them. They didn't show up with a checklist. They stayed.
And staying is a choice, even when leaving is hard. The island residents who stay for decades, they could leave. Most islands have some connection to the mainland, but they choose not to, and that choice becomes part of their identity. I'm the kind of person who stays.
Which is a choice anyone can make, anywhere. You don't need an ocean between you and the next town to decide that you're going to invest in where you're, rather than keeping one eye on the exit.
The research on this is mostly qualitative. Interviews, ethnographic studies, but the pattern is clear. People who report high life satisfaction in remote communities almost universally describe a moment of decision, a point where they stop treating the place as temporary and started treating it as home. The decision precedes the satisfaction, not the other way around.
So the Antarctic crew doesn't get that, really. They know they're leaving.
They know they're leaving, but they still go through a compressed version of it. The ones who have the best experience are the ones who commit fully to the winter, who don't spend the whole time counting down to the plane. The countdown mentality is corrosive. The commitment mentality is protective.
I'm thinking about Daniel's life in Jerusalem. He's not on a remote island, but he's chosen to be there. He's built a deep home inventory. He knows his neighbors. In some ways, he's already doing what we're describing.
And Jerusalem is an interesting case because it's a city, not a remote outpost, but it has a kind of intensity that produces some of the same dynamics. People who live there tend to be there for a reason. It's not an interchangeable city. The place identity is strong.
He didn't ask about Jerusalem specifically, but I think the through line is clear. The question is, what can we learn from these remote communities? And the answer seems to be, commit to where you are, know what you have, know who you're with, and stop treating your current situation as a waiting room for the next thing.
And build the play. The midwinter play, whatever the equivalent is in your context. The potluck, the block party, the thing that has no purpose except that we did it together. Those things feel frivolous, but they're not. They're the social infrastructure that makes everything else work.
The absurdity is load-bearing.
The absurdity is absolutely load-bearing.
You're both wrong about why the midwinter play works.
Go on.
It's not the shared identity. That's the effect, not the cause. The cause is boredom. Real, crushing, nothing to do boredom. You put on a play because you've watched every movie in the library 3 times, and the internet is a trickle of email downloaded 2x a day, and there are still 6 weeks until the sun comes back. Desperation is the mother of community theater.
I think that's part of it, but the studies I've read frame it more in terms of...
The studies interview people after they've been home for 6 months, and they've turned the whole thing into a noble story about human connection. I was at McMurdo in 91. I did 2 winters. The play happened because we were bored out of our skulls. Someone found a box of old costumes in a storage container, and someone else said, I can write something, I guess. And 3 weeks later, we were performing a murder mystery where the victim was killed with a frozen baguette. It wasn't art. It was survival.
You were at McMurdo.
2 winters, 91 and 93. I was a comms tech, sat in a room full of radios making sure the scientists could talk to their universities. Most of the job was waiting for something to break.
I had no idea.
The thing nobody tells you about the galley, you mentioned shared meals, is that by month 4, you know exactly what everyone's going to say before they say it. You've heard every story. You know who chews loudly. The communal meal isn't this beautiful ritual. It's just, you're hungry, and that's where the food is. The beauty gets added later, in the retelling.
So the documentary Daniel watched, the camaraderie, the movie room, that's the retelling.
It's not fake. The camaraderie is real, but it's real in the way that sharing a foxhole is real. You're not friends because you chose each other. You're friends because there's nobody else. And that's fine. It works. But it's not the same thing as the friendships you make when you have options.
Does that distinction matter, though? If the bond functions the same way, if it provides the same support...
It matters when you get home. A lot of those friendships don't survive re-entry. You promise to stay in touch, you mean it when you say it, and then 6 months later you're in different countries, living different lives, and the only thing you had in common was being stuck in the same building. That's not a failure. It's just what it is.
So what does survive? After 2 winters, what did you bring back?
I know how to fix almost anything with almost nothing. And I know I can tolerate about 6 months of almost anyone before I need to take a walk, even if the walk is just to the other end of the station and back. Those are real skills. The rest of it, the deep meaning, the place attachment, that's for the memoirs.
I think you're underselling it. The research on post-traumatic growth shows that people do extract lasting meaning from difficult experiences, even if the meaning isn't felt in the moment.
Sure. I'm not saying the meaning is fake. I'm saying the meaning is retroactive. You don't feel it while you're there. You feel it later when you're warm and you've had a shower and someone asks you what it was like. In the moment, you're just cold and tired and trying to remember if there's any hot sauce left.
The frozen baguette murder mystery. I want to hear more about that.
It wasn't good. But we did it. And I suppose that's the point.
It's the point. The doing it, not the quality of it.
The quality was terrible. The baguette was a prop, but it was also a real baguette, and by the third act, someone had eaten part of it. The continuity was a mess.
That's the best detail of the episode so far.
I still have the program somewhere, hand-drawn, 12 copies.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the constraints Daniel's drawn to, the limited supplies, the closed social circle, the inability to leave, aren't bugs. They're the features that force a different way of living. The remoteness isn't the point. The commitment is.
And the commitment is portable. You don't need an ice shelf. You need to stop treating where you're as temporary.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently spent 2 Antarctic winters and never mentioned it until now.
If you've done a winter over or lived in a remote community and want to tell us what the documentary left out, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.